Good morning. On Monday, the death was announced of composer Ennio Morricone. Score for The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, the seminal Western directed by Sergio Leone. And on Arena, Sean Rocks spoke to cultural historian Sir Christopher Frayling about Morricone. But just don't mention a certain pasta.
Everybody warned me that you must absolutely not mention the phrase spaghetti westerns to Morricone. It was the one. It was absolutely forbidden when you were talking to him. He thought the phrase was a put-down and rather sort of denigratory to the work of a composer. I personally think the phrase spaghetti westerns is a term of endearment, but he didn't see it like that. So I had a great warning, don't mention the spaghetti. And that said, he was very, very helpful and had a very, very close working relationship with Leone. They were, in fact, at the same primary school together in the 1930s, Sergio Leone and Ennio Morricone. And they hadn't really kept in touch in between, but when they re-met in the mid-60s, they realized that they had so much in common. And they were completely in sync to the point where in the fourth of Leone's westerns, Once Upon a Time in the West, the music was entirely written before the movie was even shot. And so they recorded it, played it on the set with an open reel tape recorder with a PA system so all the actors could hear it. And, you know, they understood each other so well that all the themes, the words, the performances were distilled into the music even before they made the movie. And that's almost unique, I think.
And Frayling spoke about the influence of John Cage on the music of Morricone.
He went on a seminar with John Cage, the avant-garde American composer, in 1958. And he said he learned from that, one, how to use pauses, that pauses are very important. Mm. Secondly, how to do unusual orchestrations that you put into the mix, all sorts of things that the audience doesn't expect. And thirdly, you use natural sounds, not in the mission, but if you take his Western scores, where he's got anvils and whip cracks and grunting noises and shrieks and all these things, and he's putting natural sounds into the mix and treating them as kinds of music. He said he learnt that from John Cage. So that there's all sorts of, you know, serious avant-garde roots in this music, I think.
Yeah, because let's listen to a little bit at the opening of Once Upon a Time in the West, which you might think is a Foley artist at play here, but this is Morricone. I'll play this underneath, and you might explain. He had been to an avant-garde concert, I think, and came back to Sergio Leone with the idea of this opening sequence, very famous opening sequence.
That's
Can
right.
you hear it there?
He wrote a theme, actually, for the opening sequence, which is three bad guys waiting at the station, and the train is 2 hours late, so they're bored out of their skulls, they don't know what to do, and they just want to shoot somebody. and so they're waiting, and they had this music written, and Morricone went to a concert in Florence, which consisted of a performance artist with a metal ladder, which he held against a microphone, heavily amplified, and did a sort of symphony for metal ladder for 20 minutes, a piece of very avant-garde performance music. And that night, Morricone phoned Leone and said, look, why don't we just construct the sequence out of amplified natural sounds, isolated and out of context, a squeaky windmill, as we've just heard, a fly buzzing, a ticker tape going, a door squeaking, and we'll do a kind of symphony of natural sounds to create the tension.
Yeah.
And he said, it's the best piece of music I never wrote.
Sir Christopher Frayling. Also in studio was oboist David Agnew, who spoke about Morricone's score for The Mission, produced by David Putnam.
Well, as an oboe player, of course, I'm indebted to Ennio Morricone for Gabriel's oboe. But the story he told was that he had a habit of using contemporary classical music to evoke the mood in certain scenes. And he'd want the music then written after that. And he was using this slow movement from the Marcello Oboe Concerto that Johann Sebastian Bach had done a transcription of for harpsichord and put in all these very elaborate ornaments. And he played this for Ennio Morricone, and he said, I want a piece like that. And Morricone said, sorry, but I can't improve on it. That to me is the most, one of the most perfect pieces of music ever written. And Putnam got quite shirty and said, well, we can't be nominated for an Oscar unless the music is original. So go away and do something. And he went away and came back with Gabriel's Oboe, which to me is the most perfect piece of contemporary oboe music ever written. It's a standalone piece that breaks your heart and puts you back together again before the end of it.
Gabriel's Oboe, performed by David Agnew, as heard on Monday's Arena. And what a lovely way to start this week's playback. A change from the COVID. But we're back to business, because the start of the week was dominated by the will he stay or will he go roundabout that was Minister Barry Cowan. Breathalysed 4 years ago on his way home to County Offaly after the All-Ireland final, he was found to be over the limit, issued with a fixed charge penalty notice, a €200 fine, and disqualified from driving for 3 months. Oh, and he was on a provisional licence at the time. Not surprisingly, phone lines to Joe Duffy were hopping. Here's how Drive Time's Barry Lenehan described making that particular cut.
Never a good thing for a government minister to feature on Joe Duffy's programme, they would tell you, especially a new minister as well.
Ooh, and ain't that the truth? And Barry brought us a flavour of those voices.
I can't believe the amount of publicity this is getting. The man made a mistake 4 years ago. He did his time. That's it. If he wasn't made a minister, would they have come after him like this?
If Neil Martin wants to do the right thing tonight, he should say to him, on your horse. Off you go. We can't have you in this government. I really believe, because already this government has had so much problems.
Okay. Barry Cowan should resign. He broke the law. I think there's been too much apologising. There's no sanctions. There's no follow-up. Words are cheap.
Well, on Tuesday night, Minister Cowan did apologise in the Dáil for what he described as a stupid, stupid mistake. And certainly when Drive Time's John Cook visited Clara in Offaly, people seemed more than willing to forgive and forget.
Yeah, we're very supportive of Barry Cowan here in Clara, and we do think it'll all blow over. Oh, I'm happy with the apology. Yeah, I'm a full support of Barry and his family and the Cowans for a long, long time. So, you know, I've always trusted in them as well. So.
And this stupid mistake, drink driving conviction, driving on a learner permit at 49, would that be common around here?
I think I'd be wise to say maybe no comment. wouldn't I?
You don't want to say any more than that?
No.
Would you think it's unusual for someone to drive on a learner permit till the age of 49?
Well, I'm sure it would, but you see, you get caught in your old ways, and if it's been let go for that length of time, then it's really, whose fault would it be then? You know, people do loads of things against the law, I guess.
And the drink driving, would there be a different attitude around that, do you think, in the Midlands or in rural Ireland?
Oh, look, I wouldn't know about that because I've never done it. I don't agree with it anyway, so...
Peter Dunnigan, butcher here in Clara. Yeah, just one of them unfortunate things that happened to him, but, like, I know the guy very well, and he'd be, you know, drink wouldn't be his thing at all, and sad, but he has apologised, and hopefully he can move on from here. He's a family man, he's children of his own, so he understands exactly the importance of all these things. Well, it's important for Offaly to have a minister, have a spokesperson at the Cabinet, and hopefully he can move on from here, you know.
Wednesday's drive time. However, in all of the opinion, and there was a lot of it, one quiet voice stood out. This is Orla.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
You're listening to this debate.
I am, yeah. Well, I suppose for me, the whole thing goes back to, I had a little boy. He was knocked down 12 years ago by an unaccompanied learner driver. And at the time, there was no law there. So we went to court, and the person who had knocked him down didn't even receive a fine. So obviously, as a family, we were really upset by this. Our little boy was sick for 4 years and then he died. The law has changed and you think that things are going to be better. I have an 18-year-old now who has done his test and passed it. And for him and for the other young people in Ireland, it's a really, really bad example, I think.
And it was in the most low-key and calmest of voices that Orla spoke of Ian and how his and all of their lives had been irrevocably changed by this accident.
But was the fact that the driver of the car, which knocked down Ian and he eventually died from his injuries, was the driver of the car anyway competent in driving, or did the authorities...
Well, my son was on the footpath.
Oh, God.
And another car came on the opposite side of the road, and the person pulled in too close to the footpath.
And this person clipped him.
He fell backwards then. He had no other injuries. I was just coming out of the house. He had nothing, only a brain injury. So when we brought him to the hospital, I'm a nurse, and actually Dr. Motherway, you know, the lady who is
intensive care unit.
She came out to me, and because I worked in Temple Street for 10 years as a nurse, and she told me that his injuries were catastrophic that day.
Oh, my God.
And they were. We went through Cork, and then we were in Temple Street and in the National Rehabilitation Hospital as well.
He was five and a half.
He was just in seniors. And, yeah, so he lived then until he was nine.
And did he live at home with you, or did he required care, obviously?
He 24-hour care. He never spoke. He was in a wheelchair. He was quadriplegic, severely brain damaged. And, you know, for us, like, we lost our perfectly beautiful, normal boy, and then we were thrown into a world of special needs and care. And, you know, I mean, he used to have 40 seizures a day. He was tube fed, suctioned. So it's, you know, a whole different world. But so that's why for me it's upsetting, because I thought when the law changed, it would be different. You know, and then, as I say, you're trying to teach young people, you know, not to drink and drive, number one, and not to drive without somebody in the car with them.
Orla on Liveline on Tuesday. Double World Boxing Champion medalist Kelly Harrington came into studio to talk to Ryan Tuberty. And when she's not training for the Tokyo Olympics, she works as a cleaner in St. Vincent's Psychiatric Hospital in Dublin. And in between her shifts, she does some shadow boxing.
Obviously, there's been no sports, no boxing over the whole COVID. So there was the European shadow boxing competition. And it was
I'd be deadly at that.
You would actually. You should give it a go.
I'm alive.
Hope you got that recorded.
No, we don't have cameras here. Keep going.
So it was countries from all over Europe, and thousands of people like put it in. But I have some imagination, so I was like, right, we'll do it in work, because I normally bring my speaker into work and I do get the staff, like the household staff and stuff, and the catering staff, we'd be up and dancing and stuff. So I told them what it was. I told them it was the European Shadowboxing Championship, yeah, and I wanted to win it. And they were like, right. So I came in, I brought my speaker in. But then it started growing. One of the workers were like, oh, I'll be the card girl. And then another one was like, I'll ring the bell on the milk jug. And I was like, all right. But it comes back. I thought I didn't hear anything for
how many people
for a while.
were taking part?
I don't know. Like there was a good few people. Like it was all staff anyways. But it was a good few people, and everyone got great crack out of it. Like everyone was smiling, yeah, and getting great joy out of it.
Were there many people competing for this? Competing for it.
There was thousands. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah, because it's European, like, okay, and there were so many people.
You're in the kind of the dining room, shadow boxing, you know, look, nearly the staff and the friends are ducking out of your shadow punches. Who won it?
I won it. I got the gold. I'm European gold medalist, shadow boxing champion without a glove landing on my face or landing on my opponent's face.
Not a bruise to show for.
Now that's the way to do it. That was boxer Kelly Harrington with Ryan. Back in a bit. Welcome back. So, are you feeling a little bit angsty, a bit hot under the collar? Angry, rolling down the car window, just ready to roar. Shouting at the radio, screaming at the telly, and generally stomping your feet. Well, if so, you're not alone. Economist Eric Lonergan spoke to Miriam O'Callaghan on Sunday about his new book, Angrynomics, and that explores the intersection of the red mist, capitalism, and politics. And Lonergan believes there's a difference between private anger and public anger, and within public anger, he draws a further distinction.
There's moral outrage, and there's what we describe as a kind of tribal energy. And one is the anger of angels, and the other is the anger of devils. Now, once you have this lens, you can make an awful lot of sense of politics.
Are you sure?
I think so. We can certainly have a go. But let me give you some examples, right? So if you think, like, to make it absolutely real today, if you look at Black Lives Matter, and that is a very good example of moral outrage. And even, you know, if you go back into the philosophy of it, that dates back to the Greek philosophers talked about moral outrage and anger as a kind of appropriate response. It's almost a measure of your character. And I don't know if you saw, there was a great interview on CNN with Cornel West, who's the sort of one of the intellectual forces, kind of the whole Black Lives Matter movement. And he said, what would it say about our society if people weren't protesting? You know, if you could see that level of police brutality on your screen and you did nothing about it. So in a sense, it's a measure of your moral compass.
So that's the anger of angels, the moral one. But what about the devil one, which he also calls the angry fan?
This was a turning point for me. This was a real light bulb moment. It was going to football matches and suddenly thinking, why is there a small group, typically of men, who are getting really, really angry? And they don't just get angry at the opposition. They also get angry at their own team. And suddenly we realize that these are little tribal regulators, that there's a small minority of people who can be very easily triggered, and they want everybody to be tribal. And now to relate this to politics, you will see Trump and a lot of the populace exploiting these two different faces of anger when it suits them. And angry people are more likely to vote. So suddenly you have a kind of story about how this might affect politics.
Eric Lonergan, as heard on Miriam on Sunday. Well, here is a woman who's certainly very, very angry indeed. She's in Texas and she believes that COVID-19, well, it's all a bit of a hoax. And as for face masks, well, just don't start her on that. Here she is talking to Sky News special correspondent Alex Crawford, who happens to be wearing a face mask.
Why are you angry if I wear a mask?
Because you're wearing a mask out of stupidity and you're further pushing the agenda. And the agenda is the deep state, which wants to control all of us and have us living in fear and thinking that you're contaminated. It is false narrative. And when you wear a mask, which you can certainly do, you are further pushing the agenda that is condemning all of us and keeps us living in a state of terror.
Wowzers, that is one hell of a viewpoint. Well, Mary Wilson asked Alex Crawford if that woman was maybe just a bit of an outlier, or was her view more widely held?
But the views that she held there, the deep state, that it's all an agenda, how widespread are those views in Texas, as far as you found it?
I mean, there was a very small group that turned up on that particular occasion outside Houston City Hall. They were definitely very much of the opinion that this was a huge conspiracy and that, well, as I said, they used words like hoax and that we were perpetuating the fear and that the virus wasn't killing more people than normal. It was a flu, and the numbers were exaggerated by the media and doctors. But even inside the hospitals that we've been to, the Houston Memorial Medical Center, for instance, where Dr. Joseph Varon said he was fighting stupidity as well as coronavirus, that was evident there with a number of the patients. He was almost at full capacity and worried about how he was going to cope over the next few weeks. And there were some of the sick people in there. One particular woman, whilst we were there, was screaming and shouting and wanting to be let out, even though she was very ill, because she believed that the doctors were making her sick. This wasn't the virus that was making her sick. It was the doctors injecting strange things into her, which was making her sick. And she actually checked herself out. This whole perception that it's a hoax perpetuated by doctors, scientists, and as they said, some unknown, mysterious factors like the deep state. It seems to, I don't know how widespread it is, it's impossible to say, but there is definitely a perception that it is overblown. And of course, that is slightly perpetuated also by President Trump, who keeps saying most people aren't ill, 90% of them aren't seriously ill. Well, the evidence from the doctors and the scientists and our own on-the-ground evidence is, well, the hospitals are full of sick people right now and most of them are coronavirus.
And he says the numbers are going up because we've got the best testing system in the world.
Sky News special correspondent Alex Crawford on Drive Time. And oh, Trump, he does love his superlatives, the bestest, bigliest, most giganticus. And there was a lot of Trump around this week. A new book about Melania Trump told us that she too is a fan of, well, perhaps exaggeration. In a new book called The Art of Her Deal, author Mary Jordan told Dave Fanning that actually there's quite a bit in common between Mr. and Mrs. Trump when it came to their relationship with facts.
She's got an official biography which will tell us that, you know, she graduated from college. No, I don't think she did. She speaks five languages. We only know of two. Did you find other anomalies like that, saying, wait a minute now, like the CV is not the truth?
Well, I found tapes of her. She had this press conference when she was 28 in Paris, and she spoke for hours to journalists. So I tracked down, you know, almost all of them, and translated from Slovenian. Many of them were Slovenian articles. And I got the tape. And in there, she says she's one of the highest paid models in the world. Yeah. And there's a back and forth, you know, okay, well, really? You know, are you one of the top models in the world? And she very clearly says yes. And it was, you know, written up at the time in many places. Well, even her own agent at the time said that's not true. I mean, it was just not true. So what's interesting to me is that Trump, you know, is famous. Her husband is famous for exaggerating. You know, he says things like he's taller than he is, that his buildings have more floors than they do. They are in many ways, more ways than we think, alike.
And Melania is no slouch in the deal making, it seems.
The big art of her deal is that Donald Trump says only rich men who do not have a prenuptial agreement, some kind of a written contract before they get married. Anyone who doesn't have that, he says, is a loser. And I'm the best negotiator in the world. I mean, he's boasted a million times.
Yeah.
Well, Melania showed that she's no dummy because she waited until she had the most leverage over him. You know, it was only when he went into politics that he cared about his public appearance, that he needed her smiling, not swatting away his hand, you know, not looking uncomfortable. And that's when she went in for the kill to renegotiate the prenup. And I'm told absolutely that she got a great deal.
Okay, so she's set up for life. She did a great deal with the prenup, and Hollywood access and all those kind of things really helped there. Because if she had said, right, I'm leaving him if he's going to go on like that, I'm leaving him because of Stormy Daniels, that would be the end of Trump, wouldn't it? Or might it be?
Well, I think his team would definitely say so, because it was 1 month before the November election in 2016. We have a woman, Hillary Clinton, was trying to make history as the first woman. And that incredible tape came out that the world heard, where he was saying things about grabbing women. It was very crude. Mm. And the campaign thought, oh, my God, you know, it was already a tight campaign with Hillary. And what are female voters going to say about this? Absolutely critical that Melania come out and defuse it. And she did. She said, it's boys talk. You know, I trust him. He respects women. She really held all the cards right then.
Yeah, exactly. And a good prenup resulted. Okay.
Mary Jordan on the art of her deal with Dave Fanning on Saturday. And all the family are out to play this week. His niece, Mary L. Trump, has written about her uncle in a tell-all book with the almost soap opera title Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. Do, do, do. Now, as the title might suggest, there's a little bit of tension between Mary L. and the Donald, so she may not be an entirely impartial witness, and she's certainly not holding back from telling the truth as she sees it. Breaking news and weekend editor of the US Guardian, Martin Pengelly, joined Ray Darcy to review the book.
She constantly refers to him as a cheat and a liar.
Yeah, a cheat and a liar, which we knew. I mean, I don't think that in that sense, in the sort of political bombshells paying off porn stars scandal sense, there isn't anything really new in the book. But as a portrait of Donald, it's astounding. There's a very short paragraph at the end, which is four lines, which if I can read,
yes,
it says
do.
A lot.
Yeah.
It kind of sums it up. I have it here. The story is that, as she tells, when her father died of a heart attack arising from alcoholism, that night Trump and his sister went to the movies. They weren't by his deathbed. And that chimes in with reporting about how Donald Trump abandoned Roy Cohn, his lawyer, when Cohn was dying of AIDS, same kind of thing. This brief paragraph is in relation to the COVID pandemic, because she's obviously, this book is very up to date in the writing. Yeah. While thousands of Americans die alone, Donald touts stock market gains. As my father lay dying alone, Donald went to the movies. If he can in any way profit from your death, he'll facilitate it, and then he'll ignore the fact that you died. And that paragraph really chimes in with reporting coming out of the White House about where the government wants to go with COVID response, which is telling Americans, yeah, get used to it, live with it, reopen. People are going to die, but we need to. Yeah. And in an election year, that's quite a remarkable stance.
Well, on Thursday, WHO envoy David Nabarro spoke to Anya Lawler on the News at One about Donald's opt-out.
How big a blow is President Trump's decision to pull the United States out of the World Health Organization?
It's really hard for me to understand the rationale for this. It's almost incomprehensible that a world leader should say, we've decided we don't like you, we're going to take away your money, right at a time when we need every country to be pulling in the same direction. If you don't like what we're doing, then you can take away money or any other support you like. But after we've got through this terrible crisis that's affecting the whole world, that it seems really hard to understand, really sad that this is being done right now. And I wish that every citizen in the world who cares about these things could find some way to send a message to the United States president saying, could you rethink? Could you just stay involved? We need America. We need the United States very, very badly right now. And you're weakening the world response if you pull the United States out.
David Nabarro of the WHO on the News at One. But when RTE's Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan hit the campaign trail in Pennsylvania to bring us this on yesterday's Morning Ireland, as you'll hear, Trump's supporters were resolute, mostly.
The virus, the Black Lives Movement, none of that is going to matter. It's just politically derived. And it's, you watch, it'll be gone after Election Day.
he's very behind in the opinion polls now. Is that something that concerns you, or do you think the polls might be wrong?
Who's promoting the polls? The media? The media doesn't want him in there? Are they going to ever do anything positive for him? Absolutely not.
Do you think he'll get in again? He's behind in the polls.
He's behind in the polls, but he was behind in the polls the last time. I think he'll for sure get in again. Oh, yeah. I hope so.
Did you vote for Donald Trump back in 2016, and will you vote for him again?
I did in 2016. I won't vote for him again. I'm sorry.
What has changed?
Him working with Putin and also killing our servicemen by bounty, and they cover the whole thing up.
Do you regret now voting for him in 2016 and helping to put him in office?
I probably do regret, and I blindly put him in office.
Voices from Pennsylvania, as heard on yesterday's Morning Ireland, and all of this against the backdrop of new moves to investigate Trump's tax returns. But whether you're Trump-tastic all the way or a Biden backer, it may all be moot if this man drops mic and turns POTUS.
I am a god. Everybody says, who does he think he is? I just told you who I thought I was. A god. I just told you. That's who I think I am.
Yipsy, Kanye West, and Philip Boucher Hayes has his eyebrows set to arch.
The first thing that needs to be said up front is that Kanye West has a new album out soon. And the last one didn't get anything like the amount of attention that Kanye felt that it should have.
I'm the number one rock star on the planet.
But he does speak about his presidency as a when, not an if.
Or, right, I thought of a name of my party that I would run with. I thought, you know, my party I'm a run with. The birthday party.
What's the meaning, man? I don't know, it's just a joke.
Or is it? In interview after interview, West has said, when I run.
When I run, I'm not going to fuck up the money. And what I like about being the founder of a $1.8 billion company is this is awesome training, because America is a company.
Kanye for president. That's crazy. Or is it? Because let's scroll back 4 or 5 years to the guy on reality TV show The Apprentice. You're fired. But Kanye or not, there is a knock-on effect of Kanye West's possible campaign. Haters, that don't kill me, can only make me stronger. I need you to hurry up, man, because I can't wait much longer. I know I got.
As improbable as a Kanye West candidacy was, it briefly energised the issue of how the Democrats respond to the Black Lives Matter campaign. One third of all black voters want someone else to run against Trump. One half of black voters feel that the Democratic Party doesn't listen to their concerns. In 2016, 8% of the black vote went to Trump. 12% of black voters would now support him following targeted campaigning by the president. Kanye West's moment of self-promotion has probably crystallized that Joe Biden's running mate now has to be not only female, but also black.
Did Philip say Beyonce? Ooh. Back after these. Welcome back. The brightest comet since Halley-Bopp will be visible in the sky all this week, if you're willing to get out of the bed. Here's Francis McCarthy, Education Outreach Officer at Black Rock Castle Observatory, with Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland yesterday.
This particular comet is typical of most of these icy objects that are left over from the beginning of the solar system. So think of a chunk of rock, ice, kind of the size of Mount Everest. So you're talking 5, 6, 7 kilometres across. Okay, and it's zipping around through space, occasionally wandering in by the centre of the solar system, goes by the sun, and we go, oh, wow, look, cute, lovely.
Cute, lovely. Would you get out of the bed for that?
So I got to say, I didn't set my alarm this morning. I wish I'd got up, because
I forgot
such
to look.
I thought I'd wait to talk
to you for tomorrow morning. So how do I see it, and where do I look?
Right now, this particular comet has zipped around the sun, which nobody was too sure if it would survive, and it has. And as it's coming away from the sun, it's going to pass reasonably close to us, you know, about 100 million kilometres away, which in space terms, that's pretty close. And as it passes, it's going to be in the northern part of the sky. So right now, if you want to see it, the easiest is before the sun rises and you look to the north. Of course, it's summer in Ireland, so sunrise is very early. So we're looking kind of 3:30, 4 o'clock. By 4:30, it's almost too bright. But it is going to be moving across the northern horizon. So in a couple of days, you'll be able to see it as it gets dark in the northwest. All right, so northwest, north in the middle of the night, northeast in the morning. Choose your time and take your chances.
And now for a little comet one-upmanship.
Will it be better than Halley's Comet?
Halley's Comet was a disaster. Halley's Comet is the one that goes around every 70 years or so. And back in 86, useless. Hale-Bopp, you may remember that one, 97,
yes.
Gorgeous.
Yes.
Particularly any telescope that you can, any comet that you can see with your eyeballs is considered a great comet. And this one is better with binoculars because it's quite a big object.
Okay.
It spreads out across the sky with exquisite tails that people are capturing in photographs.
Poor old Halley's Comet, a disaster. No exquisite tales there. That was Francis McCarthy on Morning Ireland. And there was a fierce whack of the giddy around yesterday. Maybe it was the comet, but have a listen to this.
I'm 75 years old, yes, so, and I hear clearly that soft S sound that Elton is singing. Maybe you should get your hearing checked. Oh, okay, I say, good day to you, madam. Okay, so am I meant to be hearing an S here? Come on. I'm dildanding is actually I'm still standing.
I'm dildanding.
No. Is there an S in there? Is it a, I'm spitting on myself now. First of all, I've missed my mouth for the coffee. Now I'm spitting on myself. I'm drenched. So it says I'm dildanding.
I'm dildanding.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not. That's their D's. That's it. Maybe you like Safi Suk. Have you ever heard of him? Cartoon character? Okay. Now I'm just being dilly.
And we might need a little bit of dilly ahead of this next bit. Deep breath. Here's Tony Foley, Emeritus Associate Professor of Economics at DCU. And he spoke to Sarah McInerney on Thursday and wanted to emphasise how this nasty pandemic has resulted in a recession with some very unequal consequences.
At the moment, we have, roughly speaking, half the workforce are continuing to get the same money as they got before. Whether they're working at home, whether they're not working, public servants, private sector, large companies, they're getting the same money as before. Effectively, they're better off because they haven't had the opportunity of spending it. So we've got a vast amount of additional savings in people's accounts. We estimate that this year there might be 10 billion extra in savings. And that's the half which are doing well. And in fact, some of them might be working overtime in supermarkets, hospitals or whatever, and their income is even higher than usual. And then we've got the other rough half, which is on a wage subsidy. And if the wage subsidy wasn't there, they'd be made unemployed. It wouldn't be that they'd continue on as normal. And then we've got the hundreds of thousands on the pandemic unemployment payment. So you're looking at a totally different situation to the normal scenario of where you might get 10% of the labour force unemployed or 15%. We're looking at huge numbers which are supported by the state. That's an unusual phenomenon. In terms of the numbers, it's kind of frightening when you start looking at the figures and you think the government is heading towards a deficit of anything up to 30 billion this year. If the economy doesn't pick up, next year will be another 20 billion. And we can get away with that as long as we're able to borrow the money. And the main determinant of that will be the European Central Bank. Mm-hmm. And the main determinant of that will be Germany and a couple of allies in Europe. That if there's the hint of inflation taken off, that will slow down. Now, we hope that won't happen. But it's a very unequal recession. And if it was to continue that you had hundreds of thousands of people effectively on unemployment payment and the other half or 60% of the workforce on their normal, relatively high level of income, that kind of division is not sustainable socially.
And the answer to this inequality would be good old-fashioned redistribution of wealth.
One of the mechanisms would be tax increases for those who have the jobs to support those who don't have the job.
And yet you know the government has said they won't do that.
Ah, sure. Who listens to that? You wouldn't mind that. Reality will take over eventually.
Economics Professor Tony Foley, let's not dwell on all of that. Nothing to see here. We're all just going to be fine. Just fine. Oh, look over here. Here's some funny voices.
in terms of this week. You know, we've returned to power in many ways, like a vintage Fianna Fáil sort of way. We have the cock-ups, the drink driving, shaftings, parish pump grants, and ripping each other asunder, which is very important as well. Because Fine Gael, you know, they do a sort of, in terms of a sophisticated form of backstabbing, whereas in Fianna Fáil, we're more front stabbers. You know, get the knives out. That's the Fianna Fáil way. But I'm going to win back the party because I know the way to their heart, Sarah. You know, once I can reopen the carveries of Ireland, you can picture the backbenchers. They'll be smiling behind a big plate of bacon and cabbage with the cabbage piled up the height of a small child with pints of Club Orange and the hurling back on the telly. That's the way to win those fellas back, and that'll be phase 72 of ending the lockdown. We've also got the stimulus package. It's going to be a very Fianna Fáil stimulus package now. We're going to have grants for nightclubs named after planets. We're going to have a Mike Denver concert for every town in the country. We'll have a whole month as well dedicated to clearing the backlog of communions. Very important. And bouncy castles will be compulsory, by the way. But there will be challenges as well. I mean, the Green Party, they want to put a cycling lane up through pennies. So that'll be a challenge. But we have to get the morale. You know, the morale is very low in the country at the moment. I mean, to boost the morale of men, particularly in Ireland, we're going to ask the women of Ireland to let their husbands have an extra hour every evening scrolling on dundeal.ie. Because if they want to buy alloys for a Volkswagen van, let them at it.
You know, very important.
The way they get the country back going forward in terms of...
And in the interest of balance, here's the opposition.
Yeah, finally, is that it? I mean, first of all, Sarah, I've heard you introduce a lot of men, a lot of people from the other parties, and Sinn Féin, as usual, in the RT mainstream media, is left till the end. We in the last election, might I remind you, we won more seats than any political party in ever, any election ever in the history of the world. Fine Gael lost the election. Fianna Fáil lost the election. The Greens electioned all over themselves. And we are probably going to be the ones to clean it up. But OK, at the moment, we distance ourselves from government, which, to be fair, is probably the only bit of social distancing that Sinn Féin has practised in recent weeks. But cop on.
Okay, I will.
Mary Lou, out.
For Callan, thank you so much for that.
Well, that's almost it for a playback, but let's finish with these guys who were lurking around the radio building this week, all very hush hush and kind of exciting. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.
Life ain't always empty. 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 Don't get stuck in the past. Say your favourite things at mass. Tell your mother that you love her. I go out of your way for others. Sit beneath the light that suits you and look forward to a brighter future. Life ain't always empty. 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 Sink as far down as you could be pulled up. Happiness really ain't all about luck. Let your demeanor be your deep down self, and don't sacrifice your life for your health. When you speak, speak sincere, and believe me friend, everyone will hear. Life ain't always empty. 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 Never borrow them from someone else. Buy yourself a flower every hundredth error. Throw your hair down from your lonely terror. And if you find yourself in the family way, give the kid more than what you got in your day. Life ain't always empty. 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 Thank you.
got time for it, only goes around, goes around, goes around. Take a family name for your own great sins, cause each day is where it all begins. And don't give up too quick, you only get one line, you better make it stick. If we give ourselves to every breath, then we're all in the running for a hero's death. Life ain't always empty. 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 Life ain't always empty.